Welcome to the Dialogues Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Asian American Christianity at Princeton Theological Seminary. This podcast features the voices of Asian American scholars, ministry leaders, and activists in an ongoing dialogue about theology and ministry. We provide Asian American ministry leaders with a forum for dialogue, support, and critical reflection on ministry by Asian Americans, especially in Asian American ecclesial context.
It is my pleasure to host a conversation, a podcast conversation, with my colleague and friend, Sharon Wada, who is Director of Sustainable Faith. Sharon, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to be here.
It's great having you. You know, you and I, we've developed a partnership and a conversation for the last, I don't know, year plus. On all things related to Asian American spiritual formation. And I'm so excited that you, along with Jessica Chen Fang and Jeannie Park Hearn, are plenary speakers and for the upcoming mental health conference on January 12th to 13th in 2024. And you and Carrie Myers are going to help lead three workshops on Asian American spiritual formation. This is a real turning point in the programming of the Center for Asian American Christianity. And I am really privileged to have gotten to know you and Carrie to deepen and expand our conversations regarding Asian Americans and spiritual formation. So I thought one way, and this is a kind of new podcast format this time around, because you and I are going to ask each other questions. So in a sense, we are co-hosting each other on this podcast. And I thought I would begin with just defining some terms. So the concepts and terms, spiritual formation, spiritual direction, may not be self-evident to all of our audience members. So I was wondering if you could help just define what do folks mean? What does sustainable faith mean by spiritual direction? And is it the same thing as spiritual formation? How would you define spiritual formation? Maybe we could just begin there. But I also want to highlight, I also want to ask, why is this important for the church? So there's a couple parts to this initial question.
Yeah, there's a bunch of great questions right there in what you said. And I want to maybe begin by saying it's been such a delight for me to be working with you, to be having this conversation, because I think we're coming at the holistic spiritual health and well-being of Asian Americans, and we're coming from the Christian sphere, right? We're not coming from a therapeutic sphere, though we draw from that. And I appreciate the theological framework and thinking that you bring that informs and influences my practice, my developing practice. So it's just been a really rich journey to be having these conversations. So maybe let me...
The feeling is mutual. Very, very mutual feeling.
Thank you. So let me start by saying, okay, maybe I should just explain, what is sustainable faith?
Yes.
So we are a Christian nonprofit, and we describe ourselves as a collective of pastors and spiritual directors working together to foster a culture of healthy spirituality for leaders and their communities.
Mm.
And those are all very broad terms. If you feel like you are leading as a parent, as a pastor in the workplace, and have influence in the community, which is most of us, then we welcome your participation and taking advantage of what we have to offer. We focus on spiritual formation, right, of leaders. And let me define what I mean by that. So my working definition is the process of becoming more like Jesus over time, through the power of the Holy Spirit, for the sake of others. And all of those phrases feel important to me because there's a lot of theological and practical assumptions underneath that. But one is that it takes time, that following Jesus and becoming more like him is not instantaneous. So we may have made that prayer that's very decisive. And some of us did it when we were 5 or 15 or 25. And then maybe a little surprised that, well, it's taking a long time for my character, my emotions, my thought life to be transformed. And what I like about formation is the confidence that God thinks that's perfectly fine. There's time and there's a process in which we can learn, and we don't have to get it right the first time. So all of that is very reassuring to me. So that's the process of formation. I'm going to pause and let you respond.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Because you, I think you and I know each other where we always have a lot of thoughts when we are sharing and talking. I love this idea of formation takes time. I think this is a really even urgent message for our instantaneous microwave, Instagram, you know, have it yesterday kind of culture. Everything happens at warp speed, right? And so our hyper modern society and just the delight of technology puts everything at blazing speed. Like I had to tweak my internet for this podcast recording to make sure I optimize my bandwidth to make sure we have a good quality thing. But what you're saying is that does not necessarily extend to the spiritual, in that the spiritual life takes time. Yes. And then what you said was, God says that's okay.
Yeah.
I love that, because then it kind of deflates some of the pressures we might feel about, well, I'm not perfect like Jesus yet. Yes. Yeah, God knows that. Yes. That's okay. And we need resources such as those provided by Sustainable Faith to help us lean into that timely process.
Yeah.
To become more like Christ.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, exactly. And like I said, the all of those phrases feel important to me. It's through the Holy Spirit. We are not left to our own devices. And it is not self-centered. I mean, those are some of the concerns, right? It's for the sake of others, for our expanding capacity to partner with God in whatever work we've been invited to. So it just puts to rest all the concern, the anxieties we might have about, am I doing this spiritual life right? And invites us into a process of discovery.
And then let's tag on the piece about the church. Like, why is spiritual formation something that churches and church pastors should think about more if they haven't already?
Yeah, good question. I think it's tied to discipleship, right? So what does it mean to be a disciple, a lifelong disciple? So spiritual formation is the term that we give to the internal work of being and becoming a disciple that translates into or shows evidence into what we do in our relationships, in our ministry, or outer engagement with the world.
That's really helpful. Would you, like, how do you distinguish spiritual formation from discipleship? You began to relate the two of them, which kind of sounds like there is some distinction, but they are closely connected at the same time. Can you say more?
Yeah, I think it depends on your own working definition of those terms.
Yeah,
I do think of the work of Dallas Willard, and it feels like those two terms are synonymous.
Oh, interesting.
Of what he described as a disciple. Maybe the disciple is the now, right? A disciple is one who is engaged in the lifelong formation, spiritual formation process.
Mm-hmm.
So the disciple is pointing to the who. And spiritual formation is pointing to the process or the what's happening.
Oh, that's interesting. That gives me something to think about. Spiritual formation looks at the process, and discipleship looks at the who. That's really quite helpful.
Yeah, So now, you know, I'm keeping track of your questions. So on to the question of what is spiritual direction? And that feels important. That's a big part of what Sustainable Faith offers. We offer a network of spiritual directors who feel a call to accompany leaders and who have a little more ministry experience, what we call ministry miles under their belt. And then we offer a training to become a spiritual director. So what is spiritual direction? It is a regular practice, a regular spiritual practice, that is. And it's centered around a conversation with a trained listener who will hold the space for you to unpack. What are you noticing in your life with God? What are the challenges? It's a place, you talk about pain points and pressures at some point, it would be a place to unpack and describe more fully what are you experiencing and what's your sense of God's presence, provision, guidance in the midst of everyday life and ministry. But centered around a conversation with pauses, opportunities to reflect. And it is a regular practice. So we recommend up to an hour session once a month. It might be similar to what folks understand to be mentoring or coaching. It is not therapy. So while you may cover the same topics in terms of family or work, stress, relationships, those kinds of things, it's not going to be therapeutic. So we leave that to the marriage and family professionals.
Got it. As you shared that, I want to ask, how did spiritual direction come into your life personally? Like I imagine you're leading an organization on spiritual direction because it did something for you. Would you mind sharing a little bit of what it did for you, Sharon?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, because I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it worked.
Yeah.
And I would say the practice of being in spiritual direction is the one thing that's had the biggest impact on my adult life with Jesus. So, but the beginning really was an academic introduction. So in my education at Fuller, in leadership development and spiritual formation coursework, the concept of a spiritual director and the benefits of it was introduced in lectures and reading. But finding one is a whole different story. And I think it was really a God thing, a God provision that 10 years later, the local church I was involved with had a connection relationally to a spiritual formation ministry that provided spiritual directors. So I started meeting with a director monthly almost 20 years ago, and am still meeting with the same director. And it's mostly monthly, sometimes every other month, sometimes every 3 weeks if I'm processing an important decision. And it's been a space for me to, over time, unpack what am I experiencing, what am I noticing, and how is God speaking to me in the midst of all of those complexities. So it was a space where I discerned an invitation to train as a director about 15 years ago. And I just feel like it's indispensable in terms of leading and working because it's an objective space. The director is trained to not have an opinion, not give you advice, and absolutely hold confidentiality and mirror back what they are hearing. So it's kind of a surprise and a gift that just hearing your own words back, you can step back and say, is that really what I mean? And is that really what I have conviction for? So there you go.
That is awesome. To me, the phrase that comes to my mind as I hear this process of spiritual direction is, it facilitates growth and self-reflexivity.
Yes.
It helps you to develop self-consciousness, self-awareness.
That's right.
And a component of wisdom defined by Calvin as self-knowledge.
Exactly. So
Calvin defines wisdom in the opening sentence of the Institutes for the Christian Religion to be knowledge of self and knowledge of God. And the spiritual director is helping us to grow in our knowledge of self in light of who God is.
Exactly.
So there's a rich strain within the Christian tradition to link spiritual direction and spiritual direction practices with sapiential knowledge or wisdom, sapience. So this is, that's really helpful.
I love that you just brought up Calvin there, because our spiritual direction training books will often cite that very concept. I've heard you talk about it. And as I was listening to you talk about it right now, I was thinking, okay, you hear that and it can be theoretical, right? Yeah. That there's no deeper knowing of self without deeper knowing of God and vice versa. But how does that happen? Yeah. And I think spiritual direction is one place where I can say, yes, that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so lastly, what I'll say about direction is it's a spiritual practice in service to our spiritual formation.
Mm.
Right. So it's a practice for disciples.
Fantastic.
Well, let me ask you, as you are preparing for our upcoming conference and thinking about the intersections with formation, mental health, and the AAPI context,
mm-hmm.
what are some of the key things that are coming to you to be mindful of?
Absolutely. I have a lot of thoughts. I also welcome you reining me in and redirecting me. This mental health conference, I've noticed in how folks have responded in 2021 when I first launched it with Josephine Kim and Russell Jung as plenary speakers. And then in 2022 with Jessica Chen Fang as one of the plenary speakers, a lot of people responded through their enrollment and registration. So the numbers have gone up over those 2 years. And just the energy in the discussion, in the Q&As, and even in the lounge tables, this is all virtually. And so it struck me that we Asian American Christians have several, perhaps, barriers that prevent us from addressing issues of anxiety, issues of stress, issues of broken relationships, difficult marriages, conflict and violence, even. Depression, suicidal tendencies. These are not easy topics, mm-hmm. even within church cultures, even within small groups within mm-hmm. churches. Mm-hmm. And one of my desires in hosting a mental health conference for Asian American Christians is to help destigmatize these very human issues. Mm-hmm. If you're human, you're going to encounter stress and depression and anxiety and conflict and difficulties and burnout. And sometimes receiving Christian platitudes, like just pray more, just trust in Jesus more, may actually be taken to minimize this, mm-hmm. the real suffering we are going through.
Yeah.
So I think there is both a kind of Asian shame culture as well as a Christian culture that can be dismissive of these very legitimate and real problems. And the mental health conference is designed to address these from a therapeutic as well as a spiritual formation perspective. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a general comment. The specific thing I want to say is, and let me kind of illustrate through some movies. So Everything Everywhere All at Once, I've been reflecting on this movie. Its structure as an Asian American film. So it was marketed as a kind of sci-fi, perhaps even an action sort of movie, mm-hmm. but it is an Asian American movie. And part of what makes it an Asian American movie is that it the entire plot is driven by an intergenerational family structure with Gong Gong, Evelyn, and with Joy. Mm. And the narrative is driven by conflict within these generations. The whole notion of the multiverse is generated by the choices Evelyn made to either please or displease Gong Gong, her father. the tensions that Joy experiences as the youngest child, the third generation in this film, is in direct relationship with Joy's relationship with her mom, Evelyn. Moreover, the theme, this kind of immigrant theme of laundry and taxes and this kind of disheveled and stress-filled family environment between Wayman and Evelyn, trying to make financial ends meet, and then the kind of failure of their marriage ending in divorce, these are all sort of generated out of this immigration, intergenerational family history. And it struck me that the joy and the pain of our intergenerational Asian family stories is both a mental health story, because anxiety, stress, violence, wounds, responding to wounds, these are all issues that are trauma related to some degree. And Jessica Chen Feng discusses a migratory loss as a form of trauma in my recent podcast with her. But we also want to look at these pressure points in intergenerational family life from the perspective of spiritual formation. How do they impact our faith development and our identity formation?
Yeah.
And my hope with the mental health conference is to host speakers and workshop leaders that can begin drilling more deeply both into this intergenerational family history with the pressure points therein, and how this is located within a broader social history of us being immigrants from Asia in the U.S. that have been racialized in a certain way. So I'm beginning to throw a lot out there, but I'll kind of pause and welcome your feedback.
Sure. You know, starting from kind of more of a big picture as I'm listening to you, it strikes me that you're bringing up a lot of complexity. And I think about what it is to be in the local church, to be a pastor, to be a small group leader. And especially if you're a lay leader and you've got a full-time job, or you're raising kids and you're getting them to soccer and music and so forth, your life is full. And yet everything you've just talked about, David, is real, it's impacting, and it's complex, right?
Yeah.
So I just feel like what you're doing in the Center for Asian American Christianity, what Sustainable Faith is trying to do, is let us do some of the focus study and package it in a way that maybe folks, you know, out there can start to engage with, including destigmatizing these things.
Yes.
Beginning to create a way to engage the complexity so that it doesn't feel so overwhelming.
Yep.
And one of the things that I am mindful of is it feels to me there's an assumption that you don't have to study to do any of this, right? You should just know it. Kind of marriage and family. When my husband and I were overseeing that ministry, people don't expect to have to study how to become a good marriage partner or parenting, right? We think, you just know it. And it doesn't work like that. I've got three boys, and I'm telling you right now, you don't come into the world knowing how to raise boys or girls.
I hear you.
Right. So we all had to be on a learning curve for that. And I think this whole thing of our formation, our discipleship, and as immigrants in whatever generation, and the subsequent racialization, there's no way we would just spontaneously know how to cope and respond.
Yeah. I think it's really important to provide language. It's hard to kind of grow in self-knowledge without developing linguistic sophistication. Yeah. There's something about gaining. So it's like speaking English or speaking Korean or speaking Taiwanese. Yes, it's like that level of language acquisition, but it's theology. Like, theology is a form of Christian language.
That's right.
We get our grammar and concepts from scripture, and then we begin to apply it to interpret the world as well as our lives. And spiritual formation is a kind of rehearsing of a Christian language to understand our identity formation. And I think this takes on a particularity when we we take seriously our racial and ethnic backgrounds and circumstances.
Right.
So kind of in the spirit of Calvin, knowing ourselves also involves knowing these histories that are intergenerational, familial, but also social.
That's right.
Right. This is the immigration racialization piece is part of the social history of Asians in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. And thus the title of our conference, right, of intergenerational wholeness. Knowing ourselves means knowing where we came from, both our family of origin, our people of origin, the history of that, and our current context. And so even that, knowing ourselves, it encompasses many spheres.
Hmm.
But as you have been interacting with pastors and faith communities, what are you seeing as some of the current pressure points or pain?
Hmm. That's a really good question. So I talk to a lot of pastors. Easton Law and I are doing oral history interviews. I've been thinking a lot about the last 30 years of Asian American church life, going back to the 90s. And in the 90s, Helen Lee wrote a famous article in Christianity Today called The Silent Exodus. Mm-hmm. And this essay begins to give language to a fairly pervasive experience where overseas-born Asians and American-born Asians didn't understand each other and had different needs, cultural needs, social needs. And this then created the context for the development of English congregations or English ministries as distinct from Chinese language, Korean language, first generation ministries and congregations. I think those tensions still exist. They haven't disappeared, in part because immigration is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So as immigration is ongoing, you still have more recent immigrants and more assimilated immigrants, those who speak English, those who have been in this country for decades, those who have no memory or recollection of their homeland in Asia, and who are culturally indistinguishable from mainstream Americans, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that type of dynamic still is widely pervasive and helps to explain a lot of what is going on in the intergenerational Asian church context. And I do want to say that it's become more and more evident and confirmed, and this may just seem like a no-brainer, but I do think it is a significant claim to make that Asian American church life reflects Asian American family life, that there is a deep kind of analogy or a relationship of similarity between Asian American family life and Asian American church life because of migration. So migration is the kind of social structure that I think is helpful for both unifying and then differentiating more recent immigrants, less recent immigrants, and even less recent immigrants, the first, second, and third generation. I also think that, and I don't have the best language for this. It's kind of, we can talk about the next generation of Asian American Christians. We can talk about Gen Z. We can talk about whether the Asian American church will become a faith of their own. These questions all hinge upon the next 10 to 20 years of church life for the next generation of Asian American Christians. And what I'm getting at is some very significant cultural and social shifts, and I'm not sure if the Asian American church knows how to grapple with them. I think social media during the pandemic, so social media being one of them, our phones are our lives. This is so evident with teenagers and Gen Z. The way we access information and knowledge today is all digital. Most people don't know what a physical print newspaper is anymore.
Yeah.
The artificial intelligence revolution going on is also changing how we understand what knowledge creation is in addition to knowledge consumption. These are all tectonic shifts that will affect, that affect everyone. And because everyone are those who also attend church, like, you know, we go to church on Sunday, but we live in the world around us all the time. Mm-hmm. The church can't escape these issues. And so that's a very broad kind of social commentary. But I would also say that, all right, I'm gonna use my Taylor Swift analogy, because I do this in some of my talks, and it's a helpful symbol for me to hang some thoughts on. So Taylor Swift has had one of the most successful tours to date, called the Eras Tour. Taylor Swift is an American pop artist. Yep. And the Eras Tour has generated billions of dollars in the economy. There, it's so popular that nation states are inviting Taylor to extend the tour dates so that their country would be able to host one of her concert tours. That's how big a deal Taylor Swift is. And as I began poking around on YouTube, trying to understand the phenomena of the Eras Tour, here's kind of what I have observed as a ethnographer of Taylor Swift concerts. There's tens upon thousands of people who give up thousands of dollars in some cases to access and attend and participate in these concerts, in which everyone in the stadium knows all the lyrics to all of Taylor's songs. When she is singing them, the entire stadium is singing them and dancing, to the effect where in Seattle, they thought there was an earthquake because the unified movement of bodies in synchronicity with the beat of Taylor's songs was shocking, literally shocking. It strikes me that the communal experience of attending a Taylor Swift concert is like a religious worship experience. Sometimes when you see Taylor leading a song with acoustic guitar, she looks and sounds like a Christian worship leader. She even does a sing in response with the microphone to her voice and then to the audience's voice. And so there is this spirit of unity, of passion. And I think what is so compelling about Taylor's songs and the experience of the Eras Tour is fundamentally Taylor Swift is a really incredible storyteller. She's extremely authentic. Gen Z have no patience for inauthenticity. She says what she feels. She says what she thinks. She calls out injustice in real time. If she sees something going on stage, she will call it out. Yeah. And part of what the younger generation values in Taylor Swift are all of these virtues, right, that the younger generation appreciates. So why am I talking about Taylor Swift? Because there's something about, we can call it community, we can call it identity, we can call it storytelling. And there's a sense in which the popularity of Taylor Swift is pragmatic. She's popular because she is meeting a need out there. So when churches decline in membership, when young people no longer see the utility or value or the joy of being a follower of Jesus, when the Christian faith not only is no longer compelling as a sacrifice for life, a commitment for life, but is actually now these kind of negative examples of Christian leaders who are immoral and unjust, then why would we expect the next generation of young people, Asian American or otherwise, to want to go to church? Mm-hmm. This is further complicated in the Asian American setting, where Asian American Christian children hear one thing from their parents: go to church, follow Jesus, pray. But then they see a life that is in contradiction to it.
Yeah.
All right. And they see it not only in their families, but they see it in their immigrant churches at the same time.
Yeah.
Whereas in the world, at an Eras concert, you see authenticity and integrity. Right? So if I'm a Gen Z person searching for meaning and passion and truth, and I find it at in one place and not another, where do you think I will give my loyalty and my loves? Right? So I think I'm using Taylor Swift as a secular parable so that we can have greater internal reflection amongst church leaders about what we are doing today to either be more faithful to the gospel of Jesus Christ for this upcoming generation or not. And I believe that the Spirit of Christ speaks through the world, as well as through Scripture, as well as through our neighbors. And if God is the creator and sovereign Lord of all things, of the world, and the world was made in God's image to be just, then injustice goes against the grain of God's Spirit. And we need eyes to see the forms of injustice that we may be perpetuating, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes unknowingly. And I think our young people are emotionally attuned to when things are with the grain of God's universe and when they are not. And sometimes when the older generation is not transparent and doesn't own how they are contributing sinfully to the injustice of the world, this raises a really complicated dilemma with the next generation. They're going to say, well, if I want to maintain the integrity of God's justice, then I might need to leave the church.
Right.
So I think part of my role as the director of the Center for Asian American Christianity is to listen deeply to all the generations and to find where God is speaking truthfully through and to each generation.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of why I'm interested in this intergenerational family structure, is because each generation can seem very foreign to the other, even though they may be of the same family. And I think that all the generations need to listen to what God is saying through each of their peoples. Because I think each generation has ears to hear certain things, but may struggle to hear the fullness of all that God has to say. And when we listen collectively, we have a better chance of understanding the fullness of God's saving grace. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect to go there, but that's kind of, these are some of my thoughts.
Yeah. I love that though, where you landed, when we listen collectively. And could we create the conversations that happened prior to that, that set us up to be in a place to do that well with one another, you know, where the defenses come down and the grip of shame is loosened, that you don't know everything, right? So you can say, I don't know, I would like to learn from you.
That's right. That's right. Like, I try to model with my high school teenage son when they know much more about a certain thing than I do.
Yeah.
And it takes humility on my part to kind of submit myself to my son's authority in a certain area.
Right.
That is an unfamiliar posture for me to take. But I try to do this intentionally to show reciprocation. Like, hey, a relationship is a two-way street. I really want and desire a real relationship with you. I'm struggling because now you've gone from a little child to almost a young adult. And I have to change how I relate because you're no longer exactly the same person you were 5 years ago.
That's right.
And what I'm saying is, it's these, we need to come up with language here, but it's these developmental stages of life that each generation goes through that I think generates a lot of misunderstanding and difficulty. Why? Because as we develop in our life stages, we have different needs.
Yeah.
That require different forms of relating.
Mm-hmm.
So if I related to an like a young child through a command and obedience structure. But then with a young adult, that structure does not work because they've developed in a different way.
That's right.
So by necessity, to kind of ensure the survival of the young person, a command and obedience structure is sometimes required, but it's not the case when they are of their own independent thinking and responsibility. And likewise, with elder care, I'm put in a situation now where my father has early stages of Alzheimer's. And this is a whole new thing where I can see my father becoming more dependent on me. And that's a strange feeling for me to have,
that's right.
But I see it. And I'm forced then to change how I communicate, understand, and relate to my father, given both my parents, but really my father's the one with some issues, given how they are developing in their life stages.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I see in our Christian life, in our church family, is exactly the same developmental patterns and challenges, right? So if you think about the new disciple or, the new believer, if you will, and how you might have a conversation or teach, what does the Bible say? That's going to look really different than someone who's been in the faith for 3 decades and is now a seminary student, right? So I think that's the challenge of the church. If you are a pastor or on a leadership team, the way you relate to your congregant also has to take into account, where are they in their spiritual development, let alone what's their life context? And so I think that's part of the complexity, the challenge, and why some folks are exiting the church. And in our spiritual formation work, we like the critical journey as a good description. And it's a stage theory, 6 stages. And typically, folks leave the church after stage 3. And why? Because our traditional churches are set up to best serve the early stages of our Christian formation. So that's another thing to consider when we think about the longevity, the relevancy of the church. On top of that, you've got the generational cultural differences. And then the justice issue is huge, because in our ethnic immigrant churches, if you are not sensitized to that and make space to it, it feels like you are irrelevant.
Yeah, I agree. I want to just reflect on the justice issue with you for a second. Because I can hear someone saying, well, church is not always about relevance. Sometimes we should stick it out and be faithful because it's the right thing to do. And I'm like, I'm open to that type of comment. I don't want to come across as simply being reducing everything to relevance. So I think the justice argument is a perhaps more compelling, more forceful argument. And I want to tie it to mental health issues. When things go wrong in church or in family life, when relationships are hurt, then I want to be careful here. My suspicion is there is a form of injustice lurking around. Why? Because my definition of justice is right relationships. Yeah. People who are in a right relationship with each other have a type of shalom, a type of peace, a type of harmony even. And we can just call that justice, a rightly ordered relationship. When that relationship is disrupted or broken, then it's disordered or unjust. We're not giving each other what is due each other, to use classical language. So in churches, people leave the church because either they've been hurt by the church or they feel that the church is not giving them what is their due, perhaps. And people can leave for wrong reasons. Let's focus on when people are leaving for legitimate reasons.
Yeah.
Then whatever negative experience that they've encountered, we need to ask the question, was there a form of injustice that created this situation? Likewise, with our family relationships, when there is abuse, violence, mm-hmm. stressful environments, misunderstandings. I think these joys and pains, so to speak, of intergenerational family life, these pressure points, often layered into these pressure points are forms of injustice, where we're not mutually recognizing each other as we ought to. Mm-hmm. And so I think the language of trauma is not simply emotional language or even therapeutic language. I think the language of trauma should be understood as moral and political language at the same time. And I'm thinking about justice talk as political language. Yeah. Like when there is trauma, oftentimes there is injustice. And so the trauma is diagnostic for how the church should be responding to forms of injustice. These are kind of my thoughts as a scholar, as a theologian, as I observe churches, as I talk to pastors, as I listen and carry with me stories of brokenness and hurt. I think about the case of Pastor Min Chung with Covenant Fellowship Church, in how many Christians from the 90s were traumatized through the scandals associated from that time period. And many have left the church because of those traumatic experiences, which we can use the language of these unjust events which pushed people out of the church. So again, I just want to use the language of trauma, not simply as therapeutic language, which it can and should be, but also as moral and political language tied to bad relationships or broken relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, Sharon, I want to ask you about to kind of pivot back to spiritual formation. We've been talking about Asian Americans and spiritual formation, but I want to ask you explicitly, what does it mean to contextualize spiritual formation for Asian Americans?
Yeah. The whole contextualization piece is important because whether we are conscious of it or not, what we receive wherever we are in whatever church religious context already has been contextualized, right? At the very least, the language in which we received it and the person who delivered it has already done contextualization. It's just a matter of, was it intentional? Was it conscious? Is it Eastern? Is it Western? Right? It's probably American European.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our starting point. So the question in terms of for the Asian American context is, what of what you've already been handed is what God has for you now? And it appears that we're the only ones that can do our own contextualization. Right.
Mm.
So I don't think it's realistic to think that the pastor with multiple people and multiple ethnic groups can do that contextualization for us. At least at this stage of the American church, it looks like the work comes to us. And so that is why I'm so invested in this community, this process of, can we join our efforts to begin to do some of that contextualization, the places where there are commonalities, history, of course, there are common patterns in culture and family. And then at some point, the individual has to do their own contextualization, which is a form of discernment, right? Given what I know about myself, my family, my people, what is God leading me to do and to help, to be and to respond?
Absolutely. No, I think your point about our use of language is, it's not a generic language. It's a very specific language. It's Taiwanese, it's English, and it's like West Coast or East Coast, you know, American English or what have you, right? So I think language use is a very helpful example to show how we only ever communicate in very particular forms. And there's a choice made, a kind of choice, like this and not that.
Right.
That's quite helpful for understanding context. I also think your earlier comment about formation as a time-bound process, like time doesn't occur generically for us. Yeah. It always occurs in a specific space.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So because of space-time coordination for human beings, like that is a context.
That's
we
right.
don't have omnipresence or eternity. We are not divine like God occupying all space and all time. So I think, but to name it as contextuality is really, really important. And the specific context here in this conversation is about Asians who have migrated from Asia to the US, many of us with post-1965 stories, where certain patterns begin to emerge given those shared structural histories of immigration and racialization. What is lost for Asian Americans if we don't do spiritual formation in a contextualized manner?
You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is actually we lose intimacy with God. And that's not intuitive. And what I mean by that is we lose the experience of God knowing us intimately.
Oh, wow.
And when you feel known intimately, you want to respond and move toward, right? It's an attachment. And from that, if you're moving towards the one who created the universe and has all power to equip you, to guide you, and to empower you into the world, now all of a sudden, you're more closely attached to the very source of life. So I guess as I hear myself talk about this, I think we lose the abundant life that God intended for us.
I'm also then thinking about your earlier comments relating spiritual formation to discipleship. They are both intimately connected, but perhaps in some cases, they are distinguishable. Spiritual formation looks at the process. Discipleship looks at the person to whom we are witnessing for and towards. So there's a sense in which if our spiritual formation process is not adequately contextualized, we lose that intimate attachment and connection, which then further disempowers our discipleship.
That's right.
Of following and witnessing to Christ.
Right. I think it also makes us more liable to compartmentalize our faith to an intellectual assent to a set of doctrines or beliefs without exploring what is the actual implication and application. Right. So you can check the box of what your religious affiliation is, but it's disconnected from everyday life.
Well, I want to give a shout out to a colleague who's written a really fascinating book. It's called Christianity as a Way of Life by Kevin Hector, who's a professor at Chicago. That's what you're talking about, right? You're saying that Christianity is not just intellectual assent to abstract propositional doctrines, but it needs to be socially embodied in a way of life.
That's right. So going back to our holistic Christianity, a holistic spirituality, right? An embodied, incarnational. It's all tied to who we believe God and the Trinity as Trinity to be.
Right. And I think our embodiment is never a generic embodiment.
That's right.
For you and for me, our embodiment is as Asians in the US
with
these particular social histories and oftentimes with a shared intergenerational family history. So I think to me, if I want a non-essentialized sort of framework for interpreting Asian American X, I find talking about migration and racialization that gets cashed out in this intergenerational family structure to be helpful.
Yeah.
Notice I'm not pinpointing some kind of cultural trait as the basis for our shared Asian American identity. But I'm pointing to a historical social structure that then generates patterns of shared formation.
That's right. And my assumption here is that God cares about those things too. That, in my tradition, we talk about kingdom of God. And that we emphasize that as a way of storying, if you will, what is God doing? Why did he send Christ? And so I think about it in terms of what are the signs of the kingdom in every sphere of human life, Yes, the personal regeneration. Yes, communal in the church. But what is God doing in the systems and structures in the world? And if you look at the Old Testament as a snapshot, he did have an opinion and he did care. And the whole story of Moses and the people of Israel, you can see every sphere of life, God is involved.
Maybe the last topic for our podcast, and I want to have more podcast conversations with you, Sharon. I feel like we can just keep going on and on and on. Let's talk about discernment and the will of God. Tell me more. You're the one that brought up this topic. How is this important for Asian American spiritual formation?
Yeah. Our discernment, I think, is tied to, for Christians in particular, like, what are your default assumptions, named or unnamed? So when you're trying to discern, first of all, what is the will of God, right? You know, are you looking for this pinpoint at the center of a bullseye, or are you looking for a range of things in which God is inviting you perhaps to choose? Okay, so first of all, narrowing, what is it that you're actually discerning? And then what goes into that process? And if you're coming from a place spiritually in terms of your development, maybe it's your faith community, that says you look to the authorities outside of yourself. Okay, that's one source of discernment. And then it's up to you to go find the wise person. And what if they contradict? Or what if they tell you something that's out of context because they don't understand your particular context? And so obviously there has to be some internal resonance with the external sources and signs. So when I talk about discernment, it's the Holy Spirit in you strengthening that internal process that can read the external sign, kind of put the two together, and then move forward in faith. I don't know, does that make sense?
Oh, it does. It does. How do you discern when it's the Holy Spirit versus when it's your spirit?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. So it ties back to the whole self-awareness piece, the knowing God, knowing self. It happens over time and experience and mistakes and the wins that we can celebrate. And we'll talk about this in our workshops, our spiritual formation workshops. There are actually prayer practices that can help you notice over time. And engaging in these regular prayer practices and with the spiritual director, that will help even more. You begin to discern even what lines up more with the Spirit of God, even what's in range, or that was pretty much me. Or, you know, it was something external that I couldn't control, but it was not good.
What I'm taking away from that comment is, as we know our sort of Asian American background and value systems, we can begin to put a name to that. And then we can begin to distinguish, oh, how is that with the flow of God's will?
Yes.
Or how is it not with the flow
That's
of
right.
God's will?
That's right.
Right? So we can't begin to make that distinction of with or against until we have some language attached to ourselves.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So this goes back full circle to the whole self-knowledge piece, as you said before, in why Asian American self-knowledge is cast along these intergenerational family stories that have these social histories attached to them. That is a lexicon that enriches and gives greater detail to our self-knowledge.
Yes.
So that we can begin to distinguish when we are going with the flow of God's Spirit and when we might be quenching the Spirit.
Exactly. Well said.
Well, Sharon, as we wrap up our conversation, any closing thoughts?
Just the one thing that comes to my mind to invite our listeners to come to the conference in January.
Amen.
And engage the conversation, because it's a complex world in which we live. And our experience as Asian American Christians is complex, but we've learned so much in the 2020s in which we live in terms of the neuroscience, the sociology, the theology, the history, all of that. And in my circles, we say all truth is God's truth, you know, that we assume it's part of his created order and that he offers it to us so that we might thrive, have wholeness, abundant life. And that, that's the last thing I'll say is when I say relevant, I'm attaching it to what is God's desire for us.
Oh, I like that.
In terms of wholeness, abundant life. And I believe he puts it within us, that little voice within that senses, no, I don't think so. And that's what I mean by relevance.
Relevance is a form of closeness to God.
Yes. Yes. I like that definition.
I like that too. I'm just repeating what I heard from you. Well, Sharon, I am really looking forward for our co-shared plenary.
Yes.
You and I are going to talk about Asian American theology and spiritual formation on Friday, January 12th, 2024. And I'm also looking forward to the three workshops that you and Carrie Myers will be conducting on Saturday, the 13th of January on the general theme of Asian American spiritual formation. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. And I look forward to future conversations with you, Sharon.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Dialogues podcast. The Center for Asian American Christianity invites you to join our ongoing conversation on Asian American identity, faith, theology, and ministry through the Dialogues magazine, the Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry Public Gatherings, the annual Mental Health Conference, and the annual Asian American Theology Conference. You can find more information and sign up for our newsletter at caac.ptsem.edu.